The ballot question reads, recognition of marriage solely between one man and one woman, yes or no? Good evening and welcome to a discussion of the proposed Minnesota Marriage Constitutional Amendment on the ballot November 6th. I'm Jay Anderson. If the measure passes, the language added to the state constitution will read, quote, only a union of one man and one woman shall be valid or recognized as a marriage in Minnesota, unquote. In the studio with me to discuss the various aspects of this amendment are Dale McIntyre, pastor of Cornerstone Community Church, and Evelyn Carlson, interim ministry specialist at First Congregational United Church of Christ. Both of those are in Grand Marais. Lee Matheson is an attorney with offices in Grand Marais, and joining us by phone from her office in St. Paul is family practice attorney and Cook County part-time resident Elizabeth Pierce. Welcome to all of you.
Hi, Jay.
Good evening.
You're listening to a discussion of the proposed Minnesota Marriage Constitutional Amendment on WTIP North Shore Community Radio. Now, just this week, the Minneapolis Star Tribune editorial board asked three basic questions as they argued against passage of the marriage amendment. They are, should we limit the opportunity to wed? Would matrimony be somehow redefined if gays are eligible? And most important, what does marriage mean? Now, let's start with the last one first. What does marriage mean? Just jump in.
Well, I think that is probably one of the most important questions to ask, because it is the place where most of us will need a definition in order to build a response. For me, as I look at that, I typically, when I'm resolving a problem or trying to define something, I'll typically think about it in concentric circles. So I'll think about how does a definition or a word or an understanding or a concept relate to me? What impact is it going to have on me personally? And then my next circle will be, what impact is it going to have on my family? And then maybe a larger one, my community or, you know, nation or whatever. But finally, for me, the big picture one is, what does it mean for God? And so when I look at the question, what does marriage mean, that's where I need to go, because what it means for God from my perspective actually colors and gives body and substance to all the rest of those considerations. And so when I look at the question, what does marriage mean, I think, well, what does God tell me it means? And it means a lifelong sexual and covenantal union between one man and one woman for a very specific purpose, which he gives us, which is, you know, often people say it's the propagation of children, but I want to say more than that, it is what he tells us in Habakkuk 2:14, to fill the earth with the knowledge of his glory. And the way in which God has done that, or intends to do that, is through the expansion and the population of the planet, as he tells in his word. So I see it, when I think about marriage, I'm thinking, what are God's purposes? And for that relationship, for that sexual and covenantal union that is intended to be lifelong, that God tells us that in Malachi 2:15 that he actually invests himself in.
Well, you know, from the perspective of a family lawyer who does mostly divorces, this is Liz Pierce. I have to approach the definition of marriage from a legal perspective. And from a legal perspective, it's a civil contract between two people. And right now in Minnesota, it's between a man and a woman. And so there is, at this point, no reason to amend our Constitution, because already the statutes provide that marriage is a civil contract between a man and a woman. There is no requirement that it be religious, or that there be any covenant with God. Marriage is a legal covenant within the legal parameters.
Okay.
Well, I'd say that this is Evelyn Carlson, and I look at the definition of marriage as a voluntary union of two loving, consenting adults who want to make a legal commitment. And that I believe that marriage is about love and commitment, and about being able to take responsibility for another person. I mean, that's deeply religious, I guess, a deeply religious point of view. And I also think that it should be something that is open to everybody who wants it. If we wanted to look at the Constitution, then we need to look at it from the legal aspect, not from the religious aspect.
Lee? I would agree with that. This is Lee Matheson. Liz mentioned that marriage in the law is defined as a civil contract, and under our statutes presently between a man and a woman, and picking up on what Evelyn said, to which the consent of the parties is essential. And our current statute says that lawful marriage may be only contracted between persons of the opposite sex and only when a license has been obtained as provided by law, and some solemn provisions as far as the legality. But when I think about marriage, I also think about a set of legal rights that marriage and only marriage grants to two people. And other types of relationships do not enjoy the benefits or the privileges of marriage. So marriage, in fact, while being a civil contract, I would add, is a civil contract that provides a whole variety or group of legal rights to those two people who are in the marriage.
And I do want to get to that in a moment. What Liz Pierce said brought me to a question I had, was going to ask later. But in 2005, Representative Sandra Erickson and Paul Gazelka introduced a similar marriage amendment. It passed the House, stalled in the Senate. Representative Gazelka since then has said, without the amendment, activist judges can substitute their values for those of the people of Minnesota, which is his argument against just keeping the current law in place. So would a constitutional amendment offer that kind of protection?
I'll try to address that. This is Lee again. We are getting challenges to the statute as it exists. There was just very recently a probate case in Hennepin County. I won't go into the details at this point, but it is trying to interpret not only the definition of marriage under Minnesota law, but the prohibition that is also contained in the statute on recognizing marriage entered into in another state or jurisdiction. It is still possible to challenge a constitutional amendment. There have been lots of constitutional amendments that have been challenged and struck down, not just in Minnesota. There is a similar federal law to Minnesota's Defense of Marriage Act. There is also a federal Defense of Marriage Act, and two federal circuit courts have recently found that the parts of the federal Defense of Marriage Act are unconstitutional under the federal law. So making something into a constitutional amendment may make it harder to challenge, but I'm just going to point out that it still can be challenged and constitutional amendments are struck down, and probably many of the last several constitutional amendments that have been passed in Minnesota alone have been challenged in court.
And I think that if you look at what Lee has said earlier about how marriage carries with it all these financial advantages and responsibilities, that that's why you end up with a court thinking that by denying marriage or recognition of a marriage entered into in another state, how that has creates an unequal treatment of this couple. So, for example, if you have a couple that gets married in another country, doesn't follow any of our normal rituals for marriage, they're still considered married if they were married in another country. They come here, their marriage is recognized, and they get all of those financial benefits. But if someone, a gay couple, is married in Canada and they come here, their rights are not protected. They don't get the financial benefits of being married. So those two different couples, both married in other countries, come here and they're treated differently. And what is the reason? Well, because we have this sort of fear based in religion, and I think that's the primary source of the problem.
Religions already have the right to refuse marriage to whomever they choose. They don't have to marry anybody for any number of reasons, because they're not bound under the law. Now, is that enough? Or if not, why?
Boy, I don't want to go down that road quite yet. I think we have to go back to definition, Jay.
Okay.
You know, if we talk about definition of marriage, I think we need to define the definition of what the Constitution is. And what that is about. And I understand that to be that the Constitution, whether it's a state constitution or a federal constitution or a constitution of an organization or a church, that the Constitution is about structuring that government or organization, that it offers guiding principles and a framework to help to make sure that the personal rights and the liberties are upheld, and that it's a big picture. And changes in the Constitution should be really rare and under special circumstances. So the marriage amendment does not rise to the level of a constitutional consideration, a more legislative consideration, which is what, you know, we've been talking about kind of here right now. And it's more appropriate for lawmakers' deliberation. In the church, we'd call it the bylaws. So the narrowness is into the bylaws.
Dale?
It'll probably come as no surprise that I don't agree.
Oh, really?
Hello.
Where did I go wrong?
Here's at least this is where my disagreement is. I think that what Evelyn has just said about constitutions are true, but there's another part of that that we haven't talked about, and that's that constitutions and governments are part of their job is not just to secure individual liberties, but to act for the common good, which means that they really have to look not only at the immediate but the long term and how will, because that's what God does as He works in human history. He's looking at the long term and what's the ultimate common good that He's going to arrive at, and I think constitutions have to be able to do that. They have to protect not only the individual liberties as a culture decide, but we have to be very aware of what contributes consistently and beneficially to the common good.
One of the questions that I wanted to ask, first I'd like to remind our listeners that you are listening to a discussion of the proposed Minnesota Marriage Constitutional Amendment here on WTIP. Would the legislature have to specifically pass a marriage equivalent law in order to give partners, among other things, rights of inheritance or visitation or adoption? Or do these laws currently exist if a couple would want to take advantage of them? In other words, if in fact the amendment were to pass, would there be, do you think there would be, or if there was, a movement to then clarify, for example, domestic partnership or something in the law? First of all, would that be acceptable to the people who want the amendment? And also, if there was some kind of partner agreement that may already exist, does that do the job, or is that just a lot of hoops for people to go through? And in this respect, I'm not just talking about same-sex partners. I'm talking about people who just aren't married.
Yeah, let me speak to that a little bit. What I think we have to talk about is the difference between a civil union, a domestic partnership, and a marriage. Okay, a civil union is a category of law created to extend some state rights to same-sex couples. I believe 5 states have legalized civil unions, which are only recognized in those 5 states. Domestic partnership is a category of law created to extend some rights to unmarried couples, both heterosexual and homosexual. A lot of the domestic partnership laws, there are many in Minnesota, I think at least 16 or 18 municipalities have domestic partnership laws. They're basically local ordinances, which do not even grant statewide recognition, much less beyond the borders of the state of Minnesota. So part of the problem is with the definition of those two things. The main difference that I would see between a civil union or a domestic partnership and marriage is that only marriage is recognized from state to state, as Liz just mentioned. Somebody can get married in another state in one of the, I think it's 6 or 7 states where same-sex marriage is legal, and it's not going to be recognized anywhere else. And it is not going to be recognized federally, which is what the federal courts are now debating and what the U.S. Supreme Court is probably going to have to take up. And so the point is that marriage is universally recognized from state to state and federally, whereas a domestic partnership or a civil union would not be. And so it won't do any good for the state of Minnesota to start enacting laws saying, okay, somebody who's in a civil union can inherit. There are a lot of differences in inheritance and estate tax and probate laws and so on. It doesn't solve it on a federal level or state to state.
Okay. I guess that pretty much answers that. We're also talking about even those avenues for, inheritance and this kind of stuff. This becomes a costly legal process for the individual. And what I'm hearing is that once you're married, that's it. You got it. Is that right?
Correct. You have rights. As a married person, you have rights that someone in a civil union or domestic partnership does not and cannot have, and that's partly because of it's actually really not the Defense of Marriage Act that's causing that. It's the fact that we have all these statutes. Let's just take the intestate statute, which is the probate law that controls if somebody dies without a will. A married person is entitled to a certain part of that other person's estate if they die without a will. The legislature has written that intestate law for the approximately 60 or 70% of people that aren't going to make wills. And that's not going to apply to someone unless they are married.
There are a lot of other statutes that apply, and actually there was a research done by the 515 Commission by Professor Anthony Weiner of the William Mitchell College of Law, and it was to determine the extent to which Minnesota statutes treat different families differently, and it included both heterosexual unmarried people and gay couples. And it went through and found 515 statutes that treat families differently just because of the marriage, their status as married or unmarried. And a lot of those statutes are, wouldn't impact you or me, but they might impact somebody or one of my clients, for example. For example, there's one statute that says that if you're the surviving spouse of a franchise owner, then you have the right to take over the franchise at the death of the owner. But if you're an unmarried partner, you don't have that same right. So nobody's going to go to a lawyer and write up enough documentation to cover all of those statutes. It's just not possible. What we do is we try to do wills and power of attorneys and healthcare directives to try to govern as much as we can. But like Lee said, there are statutes that are so discriminatory that there's nothing I can do to define myself as a surviving spouse. It just doesn't work. So no matter how much money I'm willing to spend, to answer your question, Jay, I can't accomplish the marriage. I can't become a surviving spouse.
What I'm starting to hear here is a very definite difference between what is a legal definition of marriage and what is the more religious or church-oriented or spiritual definition of marriage, and how they overlap and possibly conflict. I want to move on to a couple of things because I've got a couple of statements I want you to talk about. One, we've already talked a little bit about, Dale mentioned this, but let's start with this. The amendment has many supporters, some of those the Minnesota Family Council, Minnesota for Marriage, and Minnesota Catholic Conference, to name a few. So I'd like you to discuss this quote from the Catholic Conference, quote, "This is our time to stand up and defend marriage as a unique institution that, from the beginning of human history, in every culture, is the union of one man and one woman for the propagation of the human family and the upbringing of children," unquote.
Indeed, the union of a man and a woman results sometimes in propagation. And yes, that's if we want to go into the religious order of things, that is indeed what God had in mind, was that people get together and they propagate and they have families. I can say it is not true that this is true in every culture. The human family differs within cultures. The definition of human family differs within cultures. Kenya, for example, have men and women that indeed unite to produce children, but then they are allowed to even encouraged to have same-sex partners. In New Guinea, it's believed that when a child is conceived, the mother takes sole control of that child in every way. She is the feeder, she is the caregiver of that young boy baby until that boy comes to puberty. And then they enter into what we would call a gay marriage, or a gay relationship to perpetuate that maleness. So all cultures do not look at the union of men and women in the same way. And then we have to define family. What is family? How many families do we have right around us where the family are single parents sharing custody of children who go back and forth between two homes? How many families are made up of grandparents, or particularly the grandmother and their children as the caregiver? How many families are there that are absent parents and children caring for themselves? How many children are on the streets and finding family within the streets? And how many families are there that are extended families where there are several adults with children? We tend to define in terms of what we know. And in actuality, what we know is really only a small portion of what reality is.
Dale, you mentioned earlier about the concentric circles. And what the Catholic Conference is saying is that that now is the time for them to defend marriage as a unique institution. I'm hearing the uniqueness of that institution is, in your case, scriptural.
I think so. I'm going to say, first of all, I do agree with what the Catholic Conference has said and the way they've said it. But from my particular perspective, it still falls short in one particular issue that I guess I'd just like to throw in here. And it is true, and Evelyn has just pointed out, that not every culture follows what we would see, or what I would see as a biblical model. But I look at that when I hear that explanation and hear those realities. I see that as just a further indication of the mass brokenness of the human race, the departure that we've made from almost day one from what God created us to be. When he created us, he created us male and female. He said, and then he said to that man and woman, go forth and multiply and fill the earth. They decided no, they wanted a different plan. So Genesis chapter 3, along comes the garden. The serpent says, did God really say that? And they begin this path away from being and doing what God set up for them as their perfect ideal situation. And we all bear that, every one of us. And so it should come as no surprise that we can name cultures around the world that demonstrate or manifest that brokenness, that woundedness. The New Testament calls it sin, and that's missing the mark, failing to be what God has created us to be and the reasons accomplishing the reasons that he created us. It shouldn't surprise us that cultures are going to embody that brokenness and manifest it, and we all do that. And so we're all, the big goal of faith, as I understand it, is to allow God to restore us and return us to that place where we are, in fact, willingly knowing him, subscribing to his will for us, becoming like him. And I think that's part of the issue here. That's what I mean when I say that God's purpose is that the whole earth will be filled with the knowledge of his glory. Knowledge in the Bible is very frequently not just a set of facts, but an experience that changes and transforms the life. And I think that's what we're trying to get to.
Is it fair for me to say that what I'm hearing is the evangelical call to, for lack of a better word, righting a wrong or righting a misconception, and that this is, I'm not hearing a condemnation so much as I'm hearing an opportunity to change.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And there's a question here that you have listed that, I'll just jump in right now. Sure. You said, what are the right reasons for supporting the amendment and what are the wrong ones? That was a great question. I really appreciated that you put that in there. I think that there are right reasons. One of them, of course, is because there is an opportunity here to willingly look at and consider not just the legal ramifications for marriage, which are important, and both Lee and Liz have pointed those out to us. But marriage is more than just an economic benefit and is more than a legal convenience. There's more to that. And, rightly, they bring the perspective and say, we need to consider this. But I'd like to bring the consideration there's something bigger than that. And so one of that is here's an opportunity as a culture and for the common good to say, it is good for us to look at a God that we know to be holy, that we know to be just, that we know to be right, and that we know to be loving and say, how do we realign ourselves with that? And there are wrong reasons for I think pursuing that is a right reason for this amendment. But there are wrong reasons. There are people who will approach this amendment and say, I want this amendment in to punish all those gay people. Wrong answer. Wrong answer. Because that's not how God is working. God is drawing people. He's extending his love for them. He sent his son to die for them as an act of love. The other idea that also I think can sometimes come into this, and I've heard people say this, and we have to have this amendment, because homosexuality is sin and all the rest of this, and that's really an awful thing. And I think, it's all awful. If I mistreat my wife, that is sin because God has something better for me, and He tells me to what to do. If I cheat on my income taxes, that's sin. Everything that deviates from the moral standard that God is, that He is as a holy God, everything that deviates from that is sin. And so people who would use this amendment as a way of covering up their sin, saying that these people are worse than me, wrong answer. And so I think there are some wrong reasons to support the amendment, but I think there's a really good one, and that's to reflect what God's purpose is.
You're listening to a discussion of the proposed Minnesota Marriage Constitutional Amendment. Our guests are ministers Dale McIntyre of Cornerstone Community Church, Evelyn Carlson of First Congregational, as well as attorneys Lee Matheson and Elizabeth Pierce. Well, now, there's also a number of groups and individuals opposed to the amendment, and Minnesota's United for All Families, the DFL Party, the governor, and several religious organizations as well. So here's something I'd like you to discuss for a moment. This is a quote from Governor Dayton. He says, quote, I'm here to support those Minnesotans and Americans who want the same rights, freedoms, opportunity, respect, dignity, and legal protections and legal opportunities as every other one of their fellow citizens, unquote. So my question is the amendment issue fundamentally one of civil rights?
Absolutely.
Go ahead. I'll wait on you.
Go ahead, Liz.
Because I'm off-site, it's hard for me to know when people are going to chime in, and I'm sorry if I interrupted somebody. It's absolutely a civil right, and we haven't done referendums on any other minority. And one of the things is that when you're a minority within a culture, it is natural that there is discrimination.
All right. I first have to say that I have just total respect for Dale and for where he comes from and his understandings of and his experience with God and with his religious and spiritual feelings. And need to say that we are going to differ. My understanding of God, my understanding of the same scriptures that he is talking about are going to be very different. And so I have to go with the question then that you have asked is that when we get right down to what this is all about, it is about a civil issue. Not only just the right and wrong reasons, I love those too. I really like that. But it's definitely a civil issue, right? The government should not be in anybody's church telling them what they have to do or expect. Neither should there be any church or any organization, spiritual organization, that should be in our government telling it to treat one group of its citizens differently than any others. Does homosexuality marriage threaten harm marriage as we know it now? It's questionable at best. But we need not to be discriminating against any one group of people. The threat is exaggerated. Nobody can change the concept of a true, binding, eternal marriage for us and what our definition of that is, nor should we be making that same kind of assumption.
Liz,
go ahead.
I was cut off, but I did want to finish my thought, which is that it is a civil rights issue, and that if we're going to vote on people's rights, on minorities' rights, the right to marry between an African American person and a white person would never have passed in this country, ever. Now maybe it would, but in some places I'm not even sure it would that now. We can't allow our government to use its power to create groups of people who are less than the rest. And that's just fundamental fairness. And in terms of any homosexual impacting a heterosexual marriage, I'm flabbergasted that argument is even made, because there's no way that my being a lesbian has ever impacted my parents' marriage, my sister's marriage, my brother's marriage, or my kid's marriage. It doesn't impact it. That my love for them, and this comes back to what is marriage? My love for my family impacts them, but the fact that I'm a lesbian does not. It does not have any impact on their marriage, and I can't believe that Lee's marriage would be at risk if she comes too close to me. You know, it's just foolhardy to think that way. If exposure to homosexuals caused homosexuality, then I never would have ended up being a lesbian because my parents were straight.
Well, since you brought Lee into this, I was going to bring her into the conversation, not exactly that way, Liz, but Lee, do you want to weigh in on this?
One thing that Liz brought up that I thought was interesting, I was researching constitutional amendments on marriage, and I did, in fact, find those constitutional amendments from maybe 100 years ago that banned interracial marriage. And so I thought about that, and I thought, would we be having this same conversation if we were talking about banning interracial marriage, or maybe to make this a little more lighthearted, marriage between a Lutheran and a Catholic? So the question is, why is it a problem to have a ban on interracial marriage or a ban on marriage between a Lutheran and a Catholic? The reason is because you cannot discriminate on the basis of religion or gender or race. And so the question is, and this is what you're asking, is this question of civil rights? The question is, can you discriminate on the basis of sexual preference? And that's exactly what the courts are debating right now. I don't know the answer, but that is the issue.
Let's take a look at where we stand right now in terms of this amendment. A KSTP Survey USA poll last Wednesday showed the measure in a statistical dead heat, with likely voters 47% favor the amendment, 46% do not. In September, that gap was slightly wider, 49 yes, 47 no. And back in January this year, it was even wider, 48% yes, 44% no. Is this a trend that you're hearing with the people that you talk to or not?
I think there's getting to be a better understanding. I think, through forums such as this and everyone's point of view coming in, I think there's getting to be a better understanding of what is the amendment. And one thing that I want to back all the way up to the beginning when you first read the amendment and the question is, what are you voting for or against? And I just want to make really clear, if in case it's not, is that a vote for the amendment is a vote to define marriage as only between a man and a woman. A vote no on the amendment is not a vote for gay marriage. So I'm just trying to differentiate what a yes vote is from what a no vote is, because I think originally people thought that if they voted no, that they were voting for gay marriage. I think that was a point of confusion.
Really?
I think so.
So what you're saying is a vote yes means
no gay marriage.
No gay marriage. A vote no
does not mean gay marriage is okay.
Okay.
It's not a vote for gay marriage. We still have a statute on our books that defines marriage as between a man and a woman and says that any other marriage is void.
Okay.
That's correct. It's basically a codification of hatred. It doesn't create any new law. All it does is codify it in our Constitution. It takes away the possibility of changing the law.
Well, now, another recent poll shows that overwhelming support for civil unions that would offer gay and lesbian couples the same legal rights as marriage, 68 in favor, 23% not in favor. So there seems to be, it seems to be over the definition of marriage, because if 68% of the people polled seem to feel that it's okay for the state to set up, give gay and lesbian couples the same legal rights as marriage, then we're arguing over, or some people are arguing over, the definition of the word marriage. But I'm not so sure that everybody would agree with that.
Well, I think that's true. I think it's unfortunate that we use the word marriage in all of our laws, and that the churches use the word marriage as well. If instead we were talking about baptism, you know, obviously the churches get to control who they baptize and who they don't baptize, and they get to control who they marry and who they don't marry. But unfortunately, the government also marries people. And so we have this confusion, and it's unfortunate that we can't just get the churches or the government to change their language and use a different word, which might be what people are thinking about when they say use a civil union instead. The unfortunate thing is to change all of the laws would be to talk about the fiscal note on that one, it would be huge.
Yvonne, you had a comment on that?
You know, that's a really good point. As a pastor, I can baptize anyone, and I would not baptize a person probably the same way as Dale would baptize, but maybe. I can also bury anyone, but I cannot marry anyone unless I have my credentials in a county courthouse in the state of Minnesota and be licensed to do that. So all of a sudden, we're talking about marriage in a legal way. Now, I can choose not to marry a person, of course, but in order to marry a person, I have to be legally sanctioned to do that. So what does that say? That's my question.
Liz mentioned the study that was done that said that married people enjoy 515 benefits in the state of Minnesota, that people who are not married, couples who are not married, do not enjoy or have the advantage of. And there is a similar study, I believe it was by the GAO on a federal level, and that study found that there were more than 1,000 or more than 1,100 federal benefits that people who are married have that people who are not married do not have. And one of them, I'll just throw it out there. Maybe we're going to get to this, but there's a very recent case. People may have been hearing about it called the Windsor case. It just came out of the Second Circuit a week ago today, I believe. And what the case was about is about a lesbian couple who had been together for 44 years. They had gotten legally married in Canada. They were residents of New York, but New York did not allow same-sex marriage at the time they got married in Canada. Then they are living in New York. In the meanwhile, New York is one of the six states, I believe, that recognizes same-sex marriage, and one of them dies. And Windsor is the surviving partner, we'll say, Edie Windsor. And the situation there is that federal estate tax law provides for an unlimited marital deduction if you are married, if you have a spouse as defined by federal law. And as defined by federal law, Edie and her partner were not married, and therefore they were denied the, according to the court, equal protection of the law. Edie Windsor paid $363,000 in estate taxes, and if it had been a legally recognized marriage under federal law, she would have paid zero. And so the Second Court Circuit said the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, insofar as it denies equal protection under the Constitution, is unconstitutional. It's not the first court to find that, and the U.S. Supreme Court currently has four cases before it on the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, and they are going to have to hear it probably and sort out. Anytime there is a dispute between the circuits, they basically sort it out.
And needless to say, if the Supreme Court does get involved, and it looks like they probably will at some point, however they decide isn't going to make everybody happy, and probably even muddy the waters. But if, Dale, I wonder if you'd answer this for me. If, in fact, the definition of the word marriage were somehow changed by legal statute to include what we would now call civil unions or domestic partnerships or whatever. In other words, to extend that civil right to people, would that be satisfactory, or how would you react to that?
My reaction is to say I would not be surprised. It is the role of government to take the people over to whom it really is responsible and sort out and work through the details, and if necessary, spend the money to change all 515,000 laws or whatever. That's like job security for legislators. So, I mean, that's the role that we anticipate and expect. And from my perspective, that's the role that God gives governments, is to do that, to work out what is for the common good. And so it would not surprise me to find that even if that at some point or another, there comes a way of being able to say, okay, we have these folks who are in these relationships and we want to give them some type of benefit or right in relation to shared property and other things, that would happen. The issue for me is, and we've talked about it, what is marriage? Well, and not just in the terms of what legal benefits does it provide, but what is it in terms of the biggest possible picture of why it exists?
But that if there was some legal changes, that wouldn't necessarily affect the way in which you or your church or other churches that agree with you would view it. You'd still feel the same way about marriage as you define it.
I can't speak for anybody else but myself on that one, but I would just say from my standpoint, the necessity of what I think we need to bring to this conversation is that there are legal ramifications to the question, but there are much larger, I'll call them much larger spiritual questions that deserve to be considered and brought to bear on it. The definition between love and hate, Liz mentioned that a little, codifying hate. I would really love to have a conversation about what that really is and what that means and what love really is when you talk about it from the big picture of what God has done and what God intends to do in the world. I think those words get used without good definition, and sometimes we exclude things we don't mean to exclude.
You're writing my script for the future. You're listening to a discussion of the proposed Minnesota Marriage Constitutional Amendment. Our guests are ministers Dale McIntyre of Cornerstone Community Church, Evelyn Carlson of First Congregational, as well as attorneys Lee Matheson and Elizabeth Pierce. Now, we asked this question earlier of what was the right reasons for supporting the amendment, what were the wrong reasons. So let's ask the other way. What are the right reasons for opposing the amendment, and what are the wrong reasons for opposing the amendment?
I think it's pretty simple. The right reasons for opposing the amendment is that it does not fit the criteria for what a constitution is all about. And rather than defending the freedom of individuals, it seriously limits individual freedom. And that's not who we are governmentally. What's wrong with it? Again, really simple. The wrong reason is the same reason that Dale gave. The wrong reason is to oppose the amendment based on moral or religious beliefs.
Anybody else want to weigh in on that? What are the right reasons for opposing the amendment and the wrong ones?
I would echo what Evelyn said, which is historically and intentionally, the Constitution is there to provide a framework for government and to guarantee individual rights. It has not been used. I'm not aware of any amendment that has been used to restrict or limit individual rights. And so, in my mind, it also doesn't fit the definition of what should be in a constitutional amendment. You can debate all you want whether our statute is right or wrong, and our statute, it's there, and it's been challenged, I know that. Recent case in Hennepin County, a probate case that was challenging our statute. And so I think there's going to continue to be court challenges, but I would agree on a legal basis that it is not the right type of material for a constitutional amendment.
There's one constitutional amendment to the federal constitution. I think it was the 18th Amendment that prohibited the alcohol, which came into prohibition times. And it is the one amendment that was repealed. And if you look at why it was repealed because it was taking away the individual rights of freedoms and choice. And it did not belong in the Constitution because it was not structural.
Go ahead, Liz.
One of the things that I just like to point out is that I think, you know, I'm a child of the 60s, and I really think that people wanting to get married is a pretty conservative step. I think it's one of the things that allows us to protect vulnerable people and allows us to protect children. Because I do divorces all the time, and I also do Child in Need of Protective Services. And I can tell you that you're not protected. You're not protecting children by saying only heterosexuals can have children, because heterosexuals hurt their children just maybe more often than anybody else. And it is a very conservative approach. It's a very I want to be just like my parents kind of approach for somebody to say, I'm in this alternative relationship. I want to get married, and I want to be responsible for that person. I want to be able to take care of that person. If that person is sick, I want to be responsible. How is that not a conservative approach that is really moral? I mean, I just really, I really want to throw it back to Dale and say, you know, it is a loving thing to say you want to get married. It isn't anything against anybody else, and it doesn't diminish your marriage by having other people get married.
And I appreciate that perspective, but I'm gonna go back to my biggest circle here, because that's where, you know, from my worldview, that really has to give substance to everything. And if God says that this is the way you do it, and if you don't do it, there are consequences, then. And we go and do the other thing, that we should expect the consequences from his perspective. But the reason he tells us there are consequences at all is because he loves us. And he wants us to enjoy that relationship with him, not only now, not only in our immediate circumstances, but eternally, forever. And to say that, okay, because right now, you know, I want to be like mom and dad, or I want to do this, or I want to do that, even though God says it's not the thing to do and I'll have consequences, to say, okay, fine, go ahead. It's not the loving thing to do, because what it does is it supports someone in their brokenness. It's going to lead to consequences they don't want to have. And so when I think of that, I don't feel imperiled by somebody else's relationship, because I'm taking mine's grounded in the Lord. I'm not really concerned or worried about what whether or not other people have them, but I am worried and concerned about and care very much about the fact that God has laid before us a way to know Him and enjoy Him and experience Him. And because He's the one who created it and said this is the way it gets to be, He gets to own it.
But Dale, not everybody has the same religious background that you do.
I understand.
I mean, I come from a faith community where drinking is frowned upon. Okay, so should we put that into the law?
No, we
can't take my religious faith and put it into the law and make it a constitutional amendment. Why should we take your concept, what you think God is telling you, and put that into the Constitution? Why does that make sense?
Well, it only makes sense in the fact that the invitation for me to come today was to present where I come from. And I'm presenting that and allowing you, as an informed and intelligent person, to think through what I'm saying, to ask questions like you're asking, and to come to some conclusions on your own about it. It's not my intent nor my desire to impose something on you, but to offer that to think about.
We're also dealing with a huge picture, a big picture, and I think Dale is representing that, and a more finite picture, which again brings me to a partial conclusion that this is a matter of the heart for some people, and it's a matter of civil rights for others, which may very well also be a matter of the heart. And I think that that's good. I think what we're doing is we're pointing out that there's really two entirely different attitudes toward this, and that in some cases it needs to be adjudicated. And I'll just give you an example. Lee mentioned this a moment ago in Hennepin County. There was a ruling, and probably a groundbreaking one, where same-sex partners can inherit each other's assets. And that was a ruling by the Hennepin County District Court. And I bring that up because, as we mentioned earlier in the conversation, one of you did, there are laws all over the books, and some of them apply as locally as Hennepin County. Some apply statewide, some apply between states, some apply federally, and this kind of thing. So this is not obviously a question that we're going to settle, but it does point up the huge disparity between trying to make this work from one across one border into another. And I would say not only is it a matter of crossing the border between Minnesota and Wisconsin, but it might be crossing the border between this earth and the other one, whatever your view of that is. But I want to move along a little bit asking the amendment supporters are saying, and this is a quote, kids who need a mom and dad, men and women, are not interchangeable. Agree or disagree?
Check it out, she said. Murderers, convicted felons of all sorts. You know, even child molesters are allowed to freely marry and procreate and do so every day. And it's hardly a second thought by these same critics, you know? So if people are truly convinced that the children are important here, why aren't we defending the Christian values of that strive to make the society the way it needs to be? You know, feeding the hungry and taking care of the poor and clothing the naked, and we'll seek to unify and gather in the Lord's children together rather than to divide and marginalize and alienate. We need not to be obsessed over what would you call them, wedge issues and feudal legislation simply to send some message out there about moral standing.
My guess is that even the people who feel strongly about this amendment, that it should pass, probably also share much of what you've said. It's just a shift in emphasis right now about, I mean, I can't think of any Christian that's not going to want to help the poor.
And I agree.
Including those that would just as soon have an amendment. And I agree with you. I want to, one more thing, because we've only got a couple of minutes left here. Now, opponents, we've been trying to get as pro and con on this as possible, but opponents say this, in the words of Garrison Keillor, whom we all know, his quote was in a recent interview on KSDP Radio. Love trumps government, and government should not stand in the way of people who love one another. How's your take on that? I've heard it both ways tonight, and I guess I'm going to...
Well, yeah, I'll just, because I've done this already over and over again, this in the last hour, but I here again, I think we need some definitions.
Yeah.
And I think for me, when I define love, I want to look at God and see what... because Scripture tells us that God is love, so I want to know what that means. And I think that means valuing him, knowing him, understanding him as he is. And when that's true, then he becomes the criteria for all these other life decisions. And I just think that's an important definition that we need to keep talking about, keep working through.
And what I'm hearing is that and I'm glad we've gotten to this point because we're out of time. That definition is that big outer concentric circle. Mm-hmm. And what I'm hearing from some of the rest of you are definitions closer in to that in that circle. And that doesn't make those definitions wrong. It just makes them different.
I think that we can just take one step further with Dale's definition with the life of Jesus Christ and how we in the Christian community see his life and model our behaviors upon his behaviors, and I don't think that I can find a place in the New Testament where he says anything against homosexual relationships, even when he lived in a time when that was very, very common. And, you know, I speak where the scriptures speak and be silent where they are silent.
Well, that's going to have to do it for tonight. You've been listening to a discussion of the proposed Minnesota Marriage Constitutional Amendment. We did not expect to have this issue solved tonight, by the way. Our guests have been Dale McIntyre, pastor at Cornerstone Community Church, Evelyn Carlson, who's interim ministry specialist at First Congregational United Church of Christ. Cook County Attorney Lee Matheson's been with us, as has Elizabeth Pierce, who makes her home in Grand Marais while keeping a family practice law office in St. Paul. On election night, November 6th, keep your radio tuned to WTIP. We'll bring you all the national, state, regional, and local results. We'll start coverage during our Tuesday Classics program, bringing you periodic updates and early projections at 10 p.m. We begin complete coverage and will continue until it's all over but the shouting. Election night 2012. News, background, perspective, and all the up-to-the-minute results. October 6th, starting at 8 p.m. With Roger Linehan and my guests, I'm Jay Anderson.